Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month.
Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
This is the Blacklist Podcast. I, as always, am one of your two hosts, Franklin Leonard, founder and CEO of The Blacklist, joined, as always, by...
Kate Hagen, director of community at The Blacklist.
Creator of Pose, Stephen Canals, on the podcast today. We talk about a bunch of stuff. Afro-Latinx identity, the boogie down Bronx, the glory of Cardi B. What else, Kate? This is a good one.
It's a really great conversation. You know, Pose has really established itself as one of the very best shows on television. And we're going to talk to Stephen about the origins of that script all the way back to a 2004 screening of the documentary Paris is Burning. We're going to talk a bit about the complexities of the intersectional identity as portrayed by Pose and get into some of the thorny questions that have come out of the Pose writer's room as a result of that. And Stephen has some incredible answers for our usual questionnaire, including one that includes both the Color Purple and the Transformers animated film. So it's a wonderful conversation.
It is indeed. Without further ado, here's me and Kate and Stephen Canals.
Stephen, we love to kick off every conversation the same way, which is by asking if you can remember the very first movie that you saw in a movie theater, and please set the scene for us.
The very first film that I have a very vivid recollection of watching on my mom's lap is the first Terminator film.
Wow. Okay. I was not expecting On My Mom's Lap and to be followed by Terminator. Mm-hmm. You got to give us more detail, though. Where, like, was this... Because you grew up in Harlem, right?
I grew up in the Bronx.
In the Bronx.
Yeah, I grew up... My parents are from Harlem.
Okay, thank you for clarifying, because I was going to have to apologize for confusing Harlem and the Bronx, lest my mentions go on fire. But fine. Your parents are from Harlem. You grew up in the Bronx. So are we in the Bronx for this?
We're in the Bronx.
Give us the full sensory experience.
So this is 1984. I'm 4 years old. I'm a huge lover of the Transformers animated series. Still am, truth be told. Like, love Gen 1 for all the Transformer fans out there. And my mom, not so much, but my dad is a huge cinephile. Like, my father loves movies. Like, I grew up watching all of the classics and watching television with him. And, you know, anyway, all that to say, you know, I don't remember us going to the theater. I don't remember... And we used to see everything at Whitestone. So Whitestone Cinemas was in the Bronx. It's now subsequently closed, which is very sad. Like, I have so many memories of watching classic films in that theater. Because I really was the only... It wasn't that far from where we were living. Because we live, like, near the Soundview area of the Bronx. So it wasn't super far from our home. Like, Soundview, like, near Castle Hill. Like, in that pocket. And I want to say Whitestone was maybe a 20-minute walk from where we were living. And it was weird, too. Like, if you're familiar with, for folks listening who are familiar with the Bronx, like, Whitestone was, it used to be a drive-in theater. And then in the early 80s, it transitioned into being, like, a proper movie theater. But it's right by, like, the Throgs Neck Bridge. So it's just, like, this really precarious area where you have to be, if you're walking, you have to be very careful because you have all these cars driving. And it's just a very strange place for a theater to be. But anyway, the memory that I have of watching Terminator is the scene when Arnold, or the Terminator, pulls off that sheath over his arm so that you could see the metal hand. And I just remember being horrified. I think partly because in the film, the Terminator has a red eye, which the Decepticons, which are all the antagonists in Transformers, have red eyes. So I remember thinking, okay, so he's a bad guy, he's scary. But I remember my father leaning in to me as I'm, like, nuzzled in my mother's lap, like, really scared about what's happening, and him saying, whispering in my ear, it's okay, he's just a Transformer.
That might be the best description we've had. I'm just going to give it to you straight out. Here's another fun fact, because I just Googled Whitestone while you were talking. The cinema opened exactly a year before Terminator came out. So it was like a brand new theater when you were there. It opened, I guess, October 28th, 1983. And then Terminator literally came out exactly a year later.
Oh, wow.
So you really, like, it was like the brand new thing. And then RIP, it closed on in 2013. Yeah. So there you go.
But we watched, I've seen so many movies there because my uncle, my mom's younger brother, also loves movies. And so there's just a laundry list of films I remember going to that theater to see. You know, I remember seeing Aliens, Alien 3, like Home Alone, Glory. Like there's just all these like really classic like films.
Basically everything from 1984 until you left for school, basically.
Yeah, basically. Like everything and anything you could think of. I like, you know, the first Transformer animated film, the very first Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles film, like everything. Everything and anything was seen in that theater.
Do you remember what movie it was that made you decide, okay, that's what I want to do? Like maybe it was Terminator, but like was there a later film that made you say, okay, I've been watching enough of these movies, I gotta make one?
This kind of answers your question. The film that I remember watching in the theater that certainly dramatically has impacted my story sensibility is The Color Purple.
Mm.
And that it's really interesting. So the two films I would cite in terms of my being a screenwriter and maybe more specifically as someone who writes drama, I would say are the Transformers animated film and then The Color Purple. And both movies came out the same year, 1986. I was 6 years old. The Transformers animated film, because that's the film where Optimus Prime dies. And as a little boy, especially a little boy growing up in the Bronx in New York City in the 80s, which, you know, was plagued by both the HIV/AIDS and crack epidemic. And we were living in housing projects at that point. You don't have a ton of heroes. And Optimus, even though he wasn't real, felt very real to me. So that loss was very deeply impacted me as a kid. And then the other film was The Color Purple. And I think I always cite The Color Purple specifically when people ask that the question you just posed, because, you know, I grew up in a mixed family, both Black and Puerto Rican. And up until that point, at least on the big screen, like we had shows like The Cosby Show was something that we watched. I remember loving The Jeffersons as a kid, which I think at that point was already in syndication. But I don't remember ever being in the theater on a widescreen seeing people who look like members of my family. And so that was the first time I remember seeing Black faces on a large screen. The other thing about that film is the end is so cathartic when Nettie and Celie are reconnected. And so I don't know that I walked away from the experience of watching The Color Purple thinking, I want to be a filmmaker. But the thing I do very vividly remember feeling at 6 years old was whatever. Because, you know, at that age, you know, I was going into first grade and everyone's always asking, what do you want to be when you grow up? And I just remember walking away from the theater thinking, whatever I do with my life, like, I want to make people feel the way I just felt while watching this movie. So I don't know that I thought I want to be a filmmaker. To be honest, I didn't land on that until I was 15. And I was in an after-school program and I had an opportunity to work on a documentary short with classmates. So you're talking about, you know, 9 years later. But I would say that The Color Purple definitely planted the seed.
Do you remember what like your other answers were sort of between 6 and 15 when people asked you what you wanted to do?
It was everything.
But what were the things? Come on, everybody, like, you know, I wanted to be baseball commissioner, which like, I don't even know where that came from. But like what were yours?
From ages,
you know, like pre, I want to be a filmmaker. Like, what did young Steven, how did he answer that question in first grade?
So I would say from about the age of 6 to probably 10 or 11, I would always say I wanted to be a scientist. And my goal at that time, so I was obsessed with I was obsessed with the planets and the solar system and space travel. And I loved Saturn was my favorite planet because it had rings. And so I always imagined, I want to be an astronaut and I want to make my way to Saturn. So scientist or you know, an explorer, I suppose, up until about 11 or 12 and like 10, 11. And then once I realized that that's not a not a real career, I then shifted. And so there was a period of time, I was very argumentative in like my preteen and teen years. So I thought maybe a lawyer. It was interesting. In high school, there was a lot of shifts. I would say from, you know, about the age of 13 to 15, it was like lawyer. I thought for a little while, maybe a pediatrician. Then I landed on teacher for a while because my mom is a teacher. And then 15, like everything just sort of shifted for me.
But all of those things are advocates in some way, which anticipates a question that I'm going to jump and let Kate ask.
I'm curious, you know, you said you sort of made this transition around 15, and I know that comes from the world of documentary filmmaking when you were a teenager and sort of starting off there. But you also did quite a bit of work for LGBTQ plus advocacy in academia. I'm wondering about how those early experiences involving the intersection of art and social justice have kind of informed your writing, particularly as you start thinking about writing the pilot for Pose while you're at UCLA.
It's a great question. Growing up in a mixed family, conversations around race and identity wasn't something that we did often. It just was who we were and who we are. I wasn't really confronted in that way, really having to think about my own personal politics around identity until I left for college. Up until my freshman year at school being specifically my collegiate experience, the only white folks I ever had any interaction with in terms of academia were teachers. And then suddenly I had white classmates and I was being asked questions about my identity. You know, I started off my collegiate experience at a small 2-year institution that was, you know, in a very rural part of central New York. And I remember that first year being asked quite a bit by a lot of students about my identity. I was always read as mixed. So people always were like, are you black and white? And like, there were always questions.
Are they just asking you like, what are you? Like, is that the form that is coming in? Okay.
Absolutely. And you figure I left for college in 2000. And I remember the very beginning of my sophomore year was when 9/11 happened. And I just remember I'll never forget my aunt who worked at the World Trade Center. And, you know, fortunately she was there, but fortunately she was able to get out and she survived. But I remember her calling me quite a bit during that year, you know, in the aftermath of 9/11, just to make sure that I was okay. Like, she was really worried about if I was going to be the recipient of violence, like if people were going to be angry about what happened and were going to look to me. And it was interesting because I hadn't really ever thought of my identity in that way. Like, for some reason, my aunt was concerned that I was going to be read a particular way and that that was going to then result in violence.
Well, just this idea that because you were sort of black or brown, that there was just like, okay, you might be Muslim, so you might end up on the wrong end of something.
Correct. And it was a really fascinating period of time for me, those first 2 years in college. So I was just like, wow, we just never ever had to think about identity in that way. And those were not, like I said, those really weren't conversations that we were having in our family. So that was fascinating.
And do you think that deep dive into identity is what begat Pose?
Absolutely, because I think once I left, so I graduated from that institution, I wound up at Binghamton University to finish out my undergrad degree. And I studied cinema while I was at Binghamton. And it was during those final years in college that I screened Paris is Burning for the first time. It's where I really acknowledged and then stepped into my queer identity. It's where I finally met other queer people who affirmed that identity. You know, it's where I went to like my first gay club. And so I think it was really through that, the time as an undergrad, that I recognized and I think really started to acknowledge like who I am as a person and then own those different seemingly disparate identities. And then through my coursework in school, despite the fact that I was studying cinema, I spent a lot of time taking psych and soc classes. And I remember taking a class about multicultural identity. And that was the first time that I read about Kimberly Crenshaw's intersectionality. And so in thinking about self as an intersectional being, finally realizing, oh, you have all these seemingly disparate identities and they all kind of commingle together to make up who you are as a person. And then obviously once I graduated from college, as opposed to continuing to pursue a career in filmmaking, I then stepped into working in higher education as a college administrator and went back to school and worked on a master's. And my master's research was focused on the experiences of specifically Black and Latinx students at predominantly white institutions. And so I think it's a combination of my own identity and then the work that I did as a scholar and then working with college students specifically in multicultural and intercultural centers that I bring all of that into my work as a storyteller. And it's through all of that research that I realized, and I know, you know, I'm speaking to the choir and saying this to you, but you know, growing up as like young Black and Latin and Afro-Latin people, we don't often see ourselves. Like, we really have to go out of our way to find content that speaks to our identities. And so it's really critically important to me as a content creator that especially for the new generation coming up, that they don't have to really dig to find themselves in this golden era of TV where there's such an abundance of content. You shouldn't feel like there isn't a place for you. You know, you should be able to find content that represents who you are in your fullness. And so that's, Pose was really born out of that need.
Can you tell us the story of how Pose came to be? Like from the, okay, I'm going to write this show to, oh my God, this show's now on the air.
Mm-hmm.
Which, you know, for, it's an extraordinary journey for any television show, but I think for this show in particular, it's a rather remarkable one. So tell us that story, Stephen.
Sure. Well, it begins in 2004. I was enrolled in a course, Film Theory, and we had a guest lecturer that year or that semester who screened Paris is Burning. And I should note, that was such a big deal that we had an opportunity to watch this beautiful documentary because the Binghamton cinema program was and still is rooted in experimental video. So we're watching art house cinema and films from people like Stan Brakhage and Maya Deren. And so any, you know, they kind of poo-pooed mainstream cinema. And occasionally we would watch a documentary, but all that to say, it was really great that we had an opportunity to watch something that wasn't experimental. And so we watched this documentary and I was so moved by it because, as I noted earlier, my parents are from Harlem and I did not know that this community existed. And it was the first time up until that point that I'd ever seen Black and brown, queer and trans people on television. And as I noted, at that point, I was starting to explore and step into my queer identity. And so for me, I thought, oh my God, there I am. Like I hadn't really seen anything that felt like it fully embodied who I am as a person. Mm-hmm. And so, I mean, I fell in love with the movie and I did all this research. And by that point, a lot of the principals had already passed away, which was heartbreaking. And I remember thinking very distinctly while walking back to my residence hall room, that would make a really great television show. Just kind of, you know, nothing more than that.
Right.
I do remember thinking that show would be about a young Black boy who gets kicked out of his house for being gay. But, you know, and I grew up loving Flashdance. And so, you know, obviously, I mean, you still see some of that in the Pose pilot. But it was just that. It was very basic. Cut to 10 years later, I'm working on my MFA at UCLA. I'm in my second year. And I had always been feature focused in the program and I had just transitioned into writing television. And so I went into this course at the very beginning of 2014 and I did my assessment of the television landscape just to see like where are their needs and realized, gosh, we're not really seeing any Black or brown, queer or trans people on TV. And I thought, oh, I should dust off that story. So I thought, like, what are the stories to tell? And I just, you know, I remember that kernel of an idea that I'd had 10 years earlier. And I thought, oh, I should write that. And so I did. And it was, you know, I put it on the page. I felt really good about it. And then I want to say 2.5-3 months after writing it, it goes out into the industry. So this was, you know, spring of 2014. And the feedback was not positive. And I thought, okay, well, back to the drawing board.
Wait, hang on. I want to jump in. When you say the feedback was not positive, do you mean the feedback about the execution of the storytelling was not positive or that people were just kind of like, look, this is good, but I don't really see this ever getting on the air?
Both.
Both. Okay.
Yeah. So it was, you know, the writing feels off. And I also, I don't see where a show like this lives. I don't know who the audience is for a show like this. And mind you, I should note, again, this was beginning of 2014 and we were, you know, deeply enmeshed in all things anti-hero. You know, so you had like Mad Men and Breaking Bad were, you know, on television at that point. And I think that was really what was dominating airwaves by then. So I went back for another year, you know, and I wrote on other projects. And at UCLA, as I know you're familiar with, we have an internal screenwriting competition called Showcase. And at the very end of my third year, I submitted 2 pilots for Showcase. And one of those pilots was Pose. Pose didn't win, but it was an honorable mention, or at least it had enough points to be an honorable mention. You can only have technically one script that can win that competition. But on the heels of that script being circulated through the competition and folks reading it, it's wild, but the readers loved it so much that it wound up getting passed around. So coming out of my third year at UCLA, I suddenly had all of these executives reaching out to me saying they wanted to meet with me. I had managers reaching out saying they wanted to represent me. And suddenly all these doors started opening on the heels of a pilot that just a year earlier I was told had no value.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/achieve today.
Hey, folks, I'm Mark Maron from the WTF Podcast, and this episode is brought to you by Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues, your ally to help tackle your allergy symptoms this season. I love the change of seasons, but nobody loves pollen and all those other things floating in the air that make you sneeze during this nice weather. Kleenex Ultra Soft Tissues are hypoallergenic and allergist approved. So fight back against watery eyes and runny noses without worrying about irritating your skin. For this allergy season, grab Kleenex and face allergies head on.
How do you keep the positivity during that time? You know, you're being told no constantly before the doors start opening, but it's a very long process to get to that moment. I think, you know, rejection is one of the hardest things that writers have to deal with. So I'm curious how you sort of kept going, kept putting your energy behind that, the pilot for Pose during that time.
Well, I think resilience comes in the kit when you were born as a BIPOC person. I just never felt like I had the ability or the right to say, I'm too tired. You know, I feel like my, especially when I reflect on specifically my own journey and where I've come from and, you know, the experience of my parents, and to go from there to here, I'm so incredibly privileged. And I've had so many really amazing opportunities present themselves to me. And I'll probably spend my whole life wondering why, you know, why I made it out of that environment, why I've been the one who's been selected to have all these incredible opportunities when I go back to my old community and there are folks who are still there, who are still fighting, still struggling, still trying to survive. That is not lost on me. And so, you know, I don't feel like I have the right to quit. It would just feel so lazy. I think about my forebears. I think maybe more specifically, I think about my grandmothers and all the sacrifices they had to make and, you know, the thousands of miles that these women had to walk, sometimes in threadbare shoes, you know, so that my parents and then I would have incredible opportunities. And I don't want to say that, I don't want to leave anyone with the impression that it wasn't tough, because I think emotionally it's hard to be rejected, right? It's tough when people are saying no. But I never at any point during the journey ever felt like I'm going to give up. Like, it just wasn't an option.
It's really interesting because I feel like you're one of the folks that I look to who's sort of living the life when it comes to making sure that you're not the last one through the door, right? Mm-hmm. And when I think about your writer's room in particular, you know, you've mentioned that you didn't want to tokenize any one writer. And so there's not just one in the room. And I think as somebody, you know, I'm sure you've had the same experience that I have, being the only one in the room. But I'm curious about the flip on that, which is when you do have a writer's room with so many varied perspectives by design, how do you manage all of those unique perspectives and try to synthesize them into a single narrative that arguably has one perspective? And this is more a writer craft question, but it's one I think born specifically of the ecosystem that I feel like you're trying to create, that we feel like you're trying to create.
I love that question. I think what's so important is that to me, everything always goes back to two things. One is we have our central question, and then we have the themes that emerge from that central question. You know, and obviously our central question on Pose is, what did it mean to survive and to exist as a Black or brown queer and trans person in New York in the 80s in the midst of the HIV/AIDS epidemic? And out of that question, our themes then are about family and resilience and aspiration and hope. And so that's our compass, that's our guide. So as we're working through story, if we feel like we're going off track, we always go back to that central question and those themes. But what's really lovely about our show is that we have a very small writer's room. There's only five of us. Each of us has lived or been in very close proximity to New York City. And so we all have our own relationship to that environment. And so our questions and what we pose in our writer's room and then the ways that we then think about our characters, obviously, is all of it is impacted and guided by our own experiences. And so it's great. You know, we have a lot of very meaty discourse in our writer's room, not only about identity, but also about the environment that these characters are inhabiting. And so it's great. It's fun. I love sitting in the Pose writer's room and talking about digging into story and thinking about the ways that Blanca is navigating this environment versus Pray Tell. And each and every single one of us having our own very distinct understanding and interpretation of what that would look like for those characters based on our own experiences.
Digging a bit more into that idea of the complexity of identity, you know, with this year's Emmy nominations, including two for Pose, congratulations. There was quite a conversation online about the lack of Latinx representation in this year's nominees, which unfortunately neglected to include Afro-Latinx perspectives and definitely overlooked Jerrell Jerome's win last year for When They See Us. I'm wondering, as somebody who identifies as Afro-Latinx, as you've mentioned, and has a series with two Afro-Latinx leads in MJ Rodriguez and India Moore, how do you sort of navigate the complexity of that conversation while not only trying to stay true to yourself, but true to your cast, to your writer's room, to sort of all of those diverse perspectives you were just speaking about?
That's a great question. This is a really simple notion, but representation matters. We know that.
Shocking.
It's a brand new concept.
Exactly.
Representation matters. Canals 2020.
Exactly. It's even bringing the new in mid-2020. I love it.
We talk about identity in this country as if it's a brand new concept. Mm-hmm. It's akin to on the heels of Ahmaud Arbery and, you know, Breonna Taylor and George Floyd's death, we suddenly this summer acted as if racism was a new concept, you know, yep. Or the prison industrial complex disproportionately impacting Black lives was new. Like none of these concepts are new. And so I think what one of the things that has been critically important for me as a storyteller, and especially my approach to Pose, whether we're talking about, and I know your question was specifically around race, but whether we're talking about race and ethnicity, whether we're talking about someone's gender identity, is to not treat the show as if it's 101. So these might be brand new concepts to you, but we aren't going to speak to you as if they are, right? We're going to speak to you in an elevated way, and hopefully the show will then inspire you to go off and to do some research, you know, to use Google, you know, to do deeper investigations into these concepts that we are introducing through the show. And so to that point, when it comes to representing Afro-Latin voices, it's important to me because, as I've noted, I grew up in a mixed family. And my family, when I say mixed, I mean there are folks who are Black, there are folks who are Puerto Rican, and then there are folks who are Black and Puerto Rican. And right. So there's, you know, it really is truly a motley crew of identities. And that's important to be represented. You know, I think the erasure to the point, the question that you asked around Jerrell Jerome's win last year is that he was in a show that is seen as a Black show and he's read as Black, right? And so his being Dominican then suddenly gets erased from the narrative because it complicates things. Because now here you have this man who's Afro-Latin, and what exactly does that mean? You know, it's very similar to the conversation that Amara La Negra had when she was on The Breakfast Club, right? And she was suddenly, her Blackness was being policed and questioned. Like, there are folks who don't just have a proximity to Blackness, they're also Black, right. You know, and so we need to be open not only to engaging in that conversation, but also acknowledging what people's identity is. You know, for me personally, the identifying, it's been a journey to get to the place of identifying as Afro-Latin. And funny enough, actually more recently, I was thinking Afro-Puerto Rican probably makes more sense. But the reality is, like, my lineage goes back to Mali, specifically in Africa. And so for me, it's like, it's really important that I not sort of distance myself from Blackness, because we know what Black represents in this country, right? Which is what you often see happening. You know, there has to be an acknowledgement of identity and what that means for you, and then an honoring of it. And so I think that's one of the things that we try really hard to do on Pose, to just show that each of us has a very distinct and specific identity, and we want to ensure that we continue to honor it. And so I think the conversations specifically around the Emmys was connected to that erasure. And, you know, I think the thing is, it's complicated, right? Because I think while, sure, there are going to be a whole group of people who are going to say, it's terrible that you had Afro-Latin talent that wasn't acknowledged, we also saw an abundance of Black talent that was honored this year. And so I don't want us to get so focused on who isn't invited to the party that we then forget to acknowledge and give kudos to the people who were. Because the reality is, whether it's a bunch of Black folks or a bunch of Asian folks, in my mind, we shouldn't be siloed. Like, all of us as BIPOC people, like, we're all rocking in the same boat. You know,
no, exactly.
So a win for one is a win for all.
I'm curious to what extent, I mean, look, not to essentialize the Bronx here, but there are a lot of Black and Latinx folks in that community, and a lot of folks who are both, and a lot of folks who identify as one or the other. And when I think about the, you know, this weird Bronx renaissance we're living through right now that you're a part of, whether it's you or Cardi or AOC or Jesus and Mero, like, I feel like they all live in that admixture. And I'm just curious, like, to the extent that you, like, I mean, you talked a lot about sort of where you came from defines, but I'm curious, like, what was in the water in the 80s in the Bronx? Because clearly something was, because something, like, the Bronx is overrepresented in the culture right now.
And I love it. You know, and the jury's out, right? On, like, exactly where the true origins of it. But, you know, most people will cite the Bronx as being the birthplace of hip hop. And in New York, outside of hip hop, you also had, you had graffiti, which it wasn't just about spray painting a wall, right? It was so much more than that. Like, it was about liberation. It really was a political act. And so I think that those images for those of us, and it's funny the folks you cited, because we're all basically in the same age range for the most part.
Yeah, you're basically so, all within a decade of each other, and you were all growing up in the Bronx. And it's interesting. It's almost like you guys were tapping the source, and what we're seeing sort of beyond the sort of hip hop, like the very narrow notion of what hip hop is like, mm-hmm. if you were birthed in it, this is what happens. And it's just a really remarkable group of folks that all came up within the same, you know, sort of stew.
And it's interesting because I think, like, I would say myself and AOC probably more so than Cardi and D'Souza and Mero, like, we all, I don't think of myself as being, like, overtly hip-hop, even though I certainly love hip-hop culture and the music. But, you know, we grew up not even in proximity to it. We literally grew up in the middle of it all. And so I think that obviously impacts who we are and the lens with which we look out and investigate the world. But I also think that we all grew up as survivors, because this is the thing, is like, for anyone who grew up in that environment, I'll put it to you this way. It's similar to my being in a space with other queer people. When I'm around other queer people, we don't talk about our coming out narratives. Truth be told, I mean, I'm not kidding. I would say probably 95% of my friends who are queer or trans, I have no idea what their coming out journey was. Which now saying it out loud makes me sound like a terrible friend. But the reality is, like, those conversations don't happen. Like, I don't, it's just something that I don't have to ask. I already know emotionally what work and courage it took to get to that place, because I've been down that road before. And so similarly, there's this camaraderie that happens when I'm around other people who were born and raised in the Bronx, especially during that era, you know, that pocket of time in the 80s going into the 90s, we know how bleak and how devastating New York was, really in all the boroughs, but specifically the Bronx, which was just coming out of the late 70s where literally the borough was burning, you know, and there was rubble. Like, I remember as a boy, like, there was full streets you would drive down and all you saw were just piles of bricks. And it was devastating. And there was so much devastation around. And I think we all were just fighting to survive. There was no thriving at that time. You really were just trying to survive. And so I think for all of us now who are making art or creating, or in, you know, in the case of AOC, is in politics, I think it was just that we took in all of those very important lessons about what it means to be part of the community, and now we're all working really hard to try to liberate our community. I think very crudely, like, you see the criticisms, just this just popped in my head, but I'm thinking specifically about, like, Cardi and her song with Megan, right? Like, WAP. And, like, you see all of the critiques around the song specifically, right? And you have certain people who are saying, you know, it's really crude and like, but the reality is like, I follow her on Instagram. I love her Instagram. And like, she did this really funny post recently where she talked about staying moist. And it, like, and I, to me, it's like, it's so funny. And it's like, it's not just crude and vulgar. It's so like, she really is coming in and saying, I am trying to help other women own their sexuality, own their bodies. Like, these are conversations that we should be having. And there's something so powerful in that. And to me, I can make a direct connection between the messages of the song and what she's saying right now and to what it means to have grown up in the Bronx.
Yeah. And I mean, you know, I think too, it's when you have critics sort of on the conservative side of things and the far right treating a song like WAP, like it's, you know, a dispatch from Satan himself in terms of content. It really draws into focus how, whether it's the female identity or Cardi's identity beyond that, how many of these conversations we're just totally uncomfortable with having still, and how many people we can't even engage with that conversation to have women own their sexual power still. You know, kind of in that same line of thinking, I'm wondering, when it comes to Pose and the conversation around award season and nominations, as much love as the show has gotten and as critically acclaimed as it has been compared to some of its peers, MJ and India, I think, have sort of been overlooked in the awards conversation, and their nominations have been elusive. Do you think that speaks to a larger problem with the industry in terms of carrying an inherent bias towards trans actors? And do you see any kind of shifting happening around that inclusion?
The short answer is yes, I think there is bias. I remember saying that after our nominations last year, you know, and we were invited to the party, you know, we were nominated in the drama series race, which was huge because if you look at the history of the Emmys in general, but specifically the drama series category, so few shows center around Black and Brown people. We're one of the only shows, actually, now that I think about it, that in the drama series race that has been nominated that is explicitly about the Black and Brown experience. And on top of that, I think we were the only show that in the drama series race that's specifically and explicitly about queer and trans people. And while that was an incredible opportunity to have been nominated, and we were all really excited for Billy and his nomination, you know, what I said then was that you have somebody like MJ who's doing such beautiful and nuanced work, you know, or India, whose arc during that first season is one that I hear about more than any other when folks talk about the show and specifically the first season. And here they you know, there just wasn't space for them. And I think that there is this inherent assumption from cis folks, I won't even just say from the industry, but I think just from cisgender people in general, just to generalize and speak monolithically, that these women as trans women are just playing a version of themselves. And so I know it's been really critically important for me, and I think really for all of us on the show. I know Janet Mock, who's in our writer's room, has talked about this a lot publicly as well, that it's important for us to be really clear when we're doing press that there is a distinction between who MJ Rodriguez is as a woman versus the character Blanca that she is playing. They are not the same person. And, you know, it's interesting because we don't put that same pressure on straight or cisgendered actors. You know, we never come in and say, you know, well, you're a man playing a man. And so there can't be that much stretching that's happening there as a performer. And yet we're really quick to do that with our trans performers. It's somehow like, well, it's a trans woman playing a trans woman, so there can't be that much acting happening. And it's like, no, there absolutely is. And if anything, there's this added layer, a very emotional layer for all of the women on our show, because outside of them being trans women, playing trans women, we're putting them in these very emotional places on our show where, as any actor, they're having to dig into real experiences that they had. And that could be traumatizing or re-traumatizing for some folks to have to go to those very emotional spaces to unlock their character. And so I wish that there was more of an acknowledgement of the work that they were doing, all of them.
I completely agree.
Planning for your next trip? Elevate your travel style with Quince. Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/trip for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Ever catch yourself eating the same flavorless dinner 3 days in a row? Dreaming of something better? Well, HelloFresh is your guilt-free dream come true, baby. It's me, Keke Palmer. Let's wake up those taste buds with hot, juicy pecan-crusted chicken or garlic-butter shrimp scampi. Mm. Hello Fresh. Stop dreaming of all the delicious possibilities and dig in at HelloFresh.com. Let's get this dinner party started.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
It's interesting. The last time I heard somebody explicitly reference sort of this dynamic in the context of the award season was David Simon talking about the actors on The Wire and how when he would go do the award series in cocktail parties, so many of them would say, oh, it's really amazing how these actors are capable of playing themselves in the context of the show. And I think it was specifically about The Corner. And he's like, have you met Candy Alexander? Because she is nothing like the role that she is playing. And if you were aware of that, and if you made any effort to understand that, like, these people are different, they're sort of not just replacement players, you would understand just how extraordinary these performances are. And it's not their failure, it's yours. It's the failure of the judge, not the quote-unquote competitor. And so I would imagine that it's not only the trans issue, but it's explicitly the intersection of them being trans actors of color, which is making it even harder for people to think of them as anything other than sort of, oh, these are just people you pulled off the street to play themselves, and that's not acting, which is literally tragic.
It's disappointing, but hopefully coming out of the show, you know, my feeling has always been that I will see Pose as a success when the beautiful, talented women on our show who happen to be having a trans experience will have opportunities beyond Pose.
Yeah.
And not solely to play other trans characters, but just to be cast to play women. And so I think to the second part of the question that you asked, Kate, I don't know how the industry is shifting, to be honest. You know, I have a really hard time patting myself on the back when it comes to the success of show and all that, of Pose and all the accolades that the show has received, because the time that we were released, the only other show that had a trans person, a trans character, I should say, at the center of the narrative was Transparent.
Right.
And that show has ended. And so while there are trans characters on other shows, you know, and we have more trans characters on television today than at any other point, I think Pose is really still the only show where our trans characters are the center. The show is about them and their experience. And so, you know, we're 3 seasons in now. So I don't know. I mean, I think that remains to be seen whether or not the industry is shifting in any significant way. I should also note though, Franklin, that I love that you just pointed out The Wire, because it's just one of the best shows ever. Yeah. I love The Corner. Fantastic. And Candy Alexander in The Corner is brilliant. And Alexa Fogel, who is the casting director of The Wire, is our casting director on Pose.
There it is. All right. So we're almost out of time. So this is sort of the movie speed round where we're going to ask you a lot of questions about your favorite movies. I'll go first and then Kate will go and then I'll go, et cetera, until we're done. So first question, what is a movie that everyone thinks is terrible that you will defend forever? I wish that I could narrate your facial reactions here because they are extraordinary. You look deeply uncomfortable, but still joyous simultaneously.
Well, I'm trying to think. The first thing that came to mind was Flashdance, but I don't know that people think it's terrible.
That feels like an edge case. I feel like most people do think it's terrible, but also most people love it, which is an unusual dynamic. Kate, what's your ruling on this one?
Adrian Lyne is one of the most underrated directors of all time, is my take on Flashdance.
Right.
But yeah, it's one of those things that I think even if you don't think it's a good movie, you cannot argue that it is a cultural phenom and continues to be, you know, 35 years later.
Exactly. So we'll allow it.
Yeah, I feel like I need to look at a list of like terrible films. I'm like, this one, I don't... Okay.
We will allow that
Allowable.
Answer. It is accepted. Next question. Kate.
What movie do you find yourself recommending to friends most often?
Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
Love it. Great answer. All right. So this is called the Sydney Pollack question. Sydney said he was only interested in making movies about two subjects, love and war, because they're the only two things that we're no closer to understanding now than we were 3,000 years ago. So obviously, what is your favorite movie about love and what is your favorite movie about war?
Damn it. I can't repeat the same answer.
You can't. Eternal is a legitimate answer on favorite movie about love. Absolutely.
Yeah, Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind is my favorite film. I love A List, but that one is, I revisit that film quite a bit. I love it. And that ending is heartbreaking. But, you know, to me, it really synthesizes what love is all about.
So favorite movie about war?
God, there's so many ways to answer that question. Because there's like War of the Roses, which is kind of about war and love.
And that is why we ask it. War of the Roses, is it final answer?
No, I wouldn't say that though. You're all like, right, come on, pick an answer already. Favorite movies about war. We're going to get off of this call and I'm going to be like, why didn't I say that? If it's like a traditional war movie, I'm going to say Saving Private Ryan.
It's a good answer.
I think if I'm thinking more fantasy, maybe like the Lord of the Rings trilogy.
That's actually a really good answer to movies about war, which I don't think anybody's given yet, surprisingly enough.
Yeah, nobody has mentioned Lord of the Rings. What single movie moment has stayed with you the longest? This can be a single shot, a scene, a cut, an ending beat, anything in that vein.
The two things that just came to mind are the final shot in The Talented Mr. Ripley, directed by Anthony Minghella, when you have that door just closing back and forth, you know, on the boat, and you can hear the voiceover of Ripley crying, which just freaks me out. And then the other is also really dark, but it's the original ending of, which I think is heartbreaking, the original ending of Fatal Attraction, when Glenn Close is sitting in the bathroom and she cuts her wrist open. Like we see her commit suicide and then she just sort of slowly bleeds out. Something about that image that's really striking to me and heartbreaking.
Final question. If you were able to screen a single movie for every single person on Earth, time zones not, you know, being an issue, but like a simultaneous screening for every human being on Earth, what movie would you choose?
So whenever these questions get asked and then it's like everything is there and nothing at the same time.
It does happen.
I'm going to be so pissed off.
You're like, have I seen a movie ever? Exactly. Have I ever seen a movie?
This is like me during like a job interview, basically.
But then like the most random shit comes to your mind. Like for some reason right now, the thing in my head is Winged Migration, which is this doc. But I'm like, that wouldn't be the thing. Like, why would I want to have everyone watch that? But also, why is now the moment that popped in my head?
You know, I mean, it's interesting. I also just think that like, you know, there's these sort of subtle things that are bubbling up in our brain that like, we don't know why they're there. But, you know, for many reasons why. Like, I don't know. I think there's something about Winged Migration, for example, where it's like, look, there's all these things that happen amongst communities of people that happen without our thinking about it, right? Which feels very relevant right now. I don't know. I'm with you, though. We can use that as your answer. It's up to you.
I love film that forces you to wrestle with harsh realities and also film that sparks discourse. So I suppose this answer will change in 10 minutes, but I feel like right now the film that's coming to mind is Do the Right Thing.
For the record, that was both Kate and I's answer when we asked each other that question when we were practicing for the podcast. So we agreed.
Oh, no kidding.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Kismet.
And then we got to interview Spike, which was wild. Anyway, Steven, thank you for a lovely conversation as per always.
Thank you.
And congratulations on everything. Makes me very happy to see good people winning. It's pretty much what it comes down to. So
this was incredible. Thank you so much, Steven.
That means so much. Thank you.
From Luminary, the Blacklist podcast is a production of The Blacklist and Ninth Planet Audio. Our executive producers are Franklin Leonard, Kate Hagen, Han Zani, and Jimmy Miller. Gabrielle Horton is our lead producer. Nicholas Pertel composed our theme music, and this episode was edited and mixed by Kevin Liu. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at ThatHagenGirl, ThatHagenGrrl. You can find Franklin on Twitter at Franklin Leonard and on Instagram at Franklin J. Leonard. And you can find The Blacklist on both Twitter and Instagram at The Blacklist, ThebLCKLST.